ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last, and it's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down that road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales and anecdotes, as well as the many successes Southeastern Championship Wrestling. But without any further ado, before we go any further, let me introduce the man himself, the man of the hour, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you today?
I'm great, Brian. Just all set to go as usual. I think we're going to have a great program today. We're going to take them all different directions today, and got old Lightning saddled up, and I think we're ready to ride, man. Whenever you want to roll, let's get her going.
Well, don't take off on Lightning just yet. And I know we're going to pick up where we left off last week because we ran out of time. We didn't get to talk about the various talent moves. But real quick here at the top, Ron, I do want to mention because the reaction has been overwhelming. We knew people would like this episode, but people have loved this episode. The latest Super Studcast. Part 1 of Super Studcast number 17 with Jimmy Golden is available right now for patrons of the Studcast at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 gets you in the door for all the content, and especially this one. You need to hear it. It is one filled with history as well as hilarity. There is a Don Kernodle story on this Super Studcast that everyone needs to hear. And you will then have the challenge of not laughing out loud every single time you ever think of it. Because I have been since we recorded it. But we'll have more information about the Super Studcast later on in the show. But I definitely want to encourage everyone to check this out. This was a ton of fun. Ron, I mentioned that we're going to pick up where we left off last week. But where exactly are we going this week?
Well, you kind of mentioned it already. We ended last week's Studcast before I got a chance to talk about the next Coliseum event. And before I had a chance to discuss my first talent changes, as you just said, for Southeastern Wrestling, I'd like to start there today, obviously, but I want to add much more to this Studcast. We're going to Memphis to talk about the craziness happening there, not only at the box office, but in the arena as well. And then, given the time today, I want to cover the next Knoxville card, only 5 days after the second Coliseum show, and something horrible that happened on that show that would complicate my roller coaster life in a dramatic way. And so if you're ready, my man, let's just go right into it. Let's begin the show today with a brief discussion about the next Coliseum show. And after Studcast number 95, which was last week, pretty much entirely about the second Coliseum show, I started thinking about my ideal date for a trip back to that big building again. And as everyone knows, if they have listened on a regular basis, I was happy with the second Coliseum show. I was happy with the crowd and the fact that it was a successful first ever Sunday afternoon card in Knoxville. I didn't want to return too soon to that building, but the ultimate decision was very much influenced by a phone call that came just 3 days after that second Coliseum show. And that phone call was from Sam Muchnick, the president of the National Wrestling Alliance. He informed me that I could have Jack Briscoe, the NWA world champion, on Sunday afternoon or on Sunday. He didn't care whether it was afternoon or night. April 27, 1975, barely a month after this second Coliseum show. And And I would have preferred to wait a little bit, maybe 2 months before returning to the Coliseum. But dates on the world champion were really hard to come by, even for the well-established territories, and much less a new member like I am of the NWA. So I jumped on the date because Jack Briscoe was still the champion. And hopefully he's going to be the champion when that date comes around. And I'd worked with him recently a couple of times already for Jarrett. I worked for him with Jack in Memphis and in Louisville already. So I knew Jack very well, obviously, from being in the snake pit with him. And from Jack was just kind of like he was a role model for me when I was really young and starting in Florida. And I knew that when he worked with me in Knoxville, knowing that it's my town, he was going to really make me look good. So it turns out that when I get to that date, April 27, 1975, Jack does a whole lot more for me than just make me look good. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But by accepting this offer from Sam Muchnick, it means that I got the world champion twice in my first 6 months of membership in the National Wrestling Alliance. I don't think that happens to anybody. And I don't think it would have happened for me if I had not had a great relationship with Sam from those couple of years working St. Louis regularly, and the great relationship with Jack, which encourages Jack to say, hey, if Ron wants a shot, heck yeah, I want to work with him in Knoxville. So, by the way, Sam, and you know, this is for you, Brian, by the way, Sam books me in St. Louis again for January and February of 1976. And I had no idea what he had in mind in booking me for dates then upcoming 76, but he booked them anyway.
You had worked in St. Louis a good deal before this. Had at any point you been booked for dates in St. Louis this far in advance? Because you're being booked for January and February of 76. We are in March of 75.
Never. And once I started working in St. Louis, Sam called me up and said, Ron, would you be interested in working some in St. Louis? Well, obviously, no young wrestler turns that opportunity down. I said, yes, sir. I had to ask him, though. I said, Sam, have you okayed this with the Florida office? He said, I've already talked to Eddie. I've talked to your father about it. And they both would like to see you do it. So, but he never said how long this is going to be. I just assumed when I went to St. Louis the very first time that this was it. It's kind of like my going to Madison Square Garden in 1973 to work for Vince Sr. And I didn't go back. But in the case of Sam, I think Sam really liked what he saw. I don't know that he'd ever seen me wrestle, in fact, when I first went there for my first show in St. Louis. And Sam asked me immediately, he said, Ron, I want you back on the next show. And then it just started snowballing from there. I would look at my booking sheets out of Florida, and I was never, every other Friday, I was in St. Louis. So I was like, wow, this is a good deal. You know, I'm working one of the best cities in the wrestling world, and I'm working with some tremendous talent that I'd never have a chance to work with down here in Florida. And so it was a great opportunity for me. But this one really shocks me. And we're in 1975, and maybe in March, basically, of 75. And he asked me about January and February 1976. I'm like, wow, okay. I kind of thought maybe God was going to get another run here in St. Louis. You know, I didn't really know what's going to happen, and I didn't go into any details on it because I was just thrilled to get Jack Briscoe for April 27th in the Coliseum in Knoxville.
So let's get back now to some of the talent moves, because we've been teasing this now for over two episodes, Ron. What was going on with you and the talent?
Let's take a look at my first talent change. You know, you have to change talent as a booker, obviously as an owner too. And it's just part of the business. And it's my first talent change for Southeastern. And as regular listeners know, in the winter of 1975, I had Dutch Mantell, I had John Foley, I had Dale Lewis, I had Ron and Don Wright, I had Rocky Smith, the club-footed Inferno, and I had Jimmy Golden, who had just come in and was part of the crew. And two of that group actually came to me and said they wanted to leave. Dutch had an opportunity, Dutch Mantell, had an opportunity to get a good spot in the great territory. And John Foley wanted to return to England. And these were the first two wrestlers ever to give me a notice as a booker and an owner. That's, you know, it's kind of odd that I even remember that, but it was the first two guys that I actually got to work for me. And they were the first two to give me a notice to say that they wanted to go somewhere else. So as was customary, after giving their notice, they would be leaving Knoxville in 2 weeks. And it would happen many other times as I continued to build territories throughout my career. I was young and new at this, but I handled it in the same way and with the same philosophy as I always would. Because I had grown up in a wrestling family, to me, the wrestling business was designed to develop great wrestlers. Take care of them in every way you could while they worked for you and move them or allow them to go whenever they had a better opportunity. I had never felt like it was right. And this stayed to the end of my wrestling career and my ownership career. I never felt like it was right to hold anyone back that could better their money or their position in the wrestling business. So over the next 14 years, I'm going to develop some of the greatest wrestlers in the history of this sport. And I think every one of them would tell you that I always tried to do what was best for them and not what was best for me.
In your time as a promoter, these are the first two guys that left and gave notice. Did you have guys that left without giving you any notice?
Occasionally, yes. But very rarely. Guys really liked working for me. I was lucky that I had territories that were making money. Everybody was happy and most of the time and making very good money. And it did not happen very, very often. John Valiant left me in Southeastern and Dothan with a 2-day notice. And it really hurt me. You know, I mean, I wasn't accustomed to that. And I really don't know what upset John, but something he didn't like. And he wasn't specific. I don't think I even asked him. He said, "I want to leave in 2 days. I want to finish up." And I said, "Okay, that's what you want." You know, I didn't really know him very well when he came. And he only was there maybe a month before he did it. But I didn't have him very often.
So, Ron, here you are. You have a couple of the guys in your crew, a couple of the first guys that you bring in, Dutch Mantell and John Foley, leave. You were able to get away from the booking arrangement with the Nashville booking office, your grandfather and Nick Goulas. But part of the reason you wanted to was to have your own talent, and you had your own talent. What do you do when you lose a couple guys? You don't have any plans to bring anyone in just yet. How do you fill in that gap?
Well, luckily, I'm working across the state in Memphis for Jerry Jarrett, and I'm going to rely on Jerry Jarrett for the next couple of months to help me with talent. And as you say, do that unexpected loss of Mantell and Foley, I need a tag team. And boy, he comes through strong for me. He sends me over on Fridays, Jack and Jim Dalton. During this couple of month time frame, Ron and Don Bass, managed by Sam Bass, the Infernos, and George Barnes and Bill Dundee, the great Australian team. And I'm going to also start bringing in more of my own guys. I'm going to start looking immediately for new talent. One of those guys is going to be Tommy Siegler, who is a great worker at that point in his life. I'm going to bring in the original assassin, Jody Hamilton, Rock Hunter, and a young guy named George McCrary, who's a pretty decent talent in his own right. So I'm going to be able to fill the holes. But, you know, it kind of shocked me because I wasn't expecting it. But I never wanted to hold those guys back. I was real happy to see Dutch get that spot in a great territory. And obviously, John Foley was just homesick. He wanted to go back to England.
Ron, before we get to what else you were doing in this period of time, I want to ask you about a few of the wrestlers that you just mentioned. The Infernos, let's start with that. you have Rocky Smith working for you. So when you have the Infernos, is he one of the Infernos or is it a different set of Infernos?
No, he is one of the Infernos. What happens is Jerry is coming in and working a lot of these shows, and he sees Rocky Smith, and he knows Rocky Smith was the club-footed Inferno. So he asked me, he says, do you care if I start to book Rocky some? I mean, obviously you'll have him on Fridays and whatever nights you want him, but I would like to put together an Inferno team. And that's where he gets his Inferno team. He goes back to the great Rocky Smith, who was the man on that team. Obviously, Ron and Don Bass. Sam Bass, I don't know how much people know about Sam Bass. He was an absolutely phenomenal manager and a great person. I really, really love Sam Bass.
Did you ever see Ma Bass?
I never met her. I never saw that angle worked, and she never worked for me. Neither did Ron. Now, Ron Bass is going to work for me in 1980 and 81 in Pensacola. And I didn't have much business dealings with Don Bass. Ron comes by himself in 1980 and 81 working for me there. But the Dalton brothers, pretty decent, especially Jim. Jim Dalton, a good worker, worked with partners with Don Fargo. Gosh, man, what a tremendous team they made, Don Fargo and Jim Foley. I mean, Jim Dalton, really great team. So I'm very familiar with Dalton, with Jim especially. And then George Barnes and Bill Dundee, I can't say enough about those two guys. Well, they were just off the charts as a wrestling team together. Tremendous talents, both of them.
One more question when it relates to this talent, Ron. Dutch Mantel is leaving, but pretty soon you're going to be bringing in, like you said, Tommy Siegler, the Assassin, Jody Hamilton. Tom Ernesto was retired as a wrestler by this period of time, I believe, and Rock Hunter. All of those guys had worked for Ann Gunkel and All South. Did you not hold any grudge against them personally? I mean, tell me, did you have any thoughts, any concerns about bringing these guys in, considering they had run opposition to your family and the NWA? What was your mindset about using guys who had worked for All South?
Well, it's a few years after that all went down. And, you know, gosh, I'm a young guy. I'm 27 years old. I have two guys give me a notice. I'm looking for good talent. I don't believe in holding grudges against people that do what they think in their own mind is right. And Jody Hamilton was such a phenomenal talent. And my brother and I had started in Georgia in 1970 working with Jody Hamilton and Tom Ernesto. And wow, I never forgot how good he was. And I knew what he could do for me. And I brought him there. Rock Hunter, I wasn't as knowledgeable about Rock, but he was very close to Jody Hamilton. And then when they both wanted to come, I said, absolutely. I figured, you know, what happened in Georgia is in the past, and it's not my territory. It was someone else's territory. And I just felt like that they had paid some dues. I'm sure that they had sat around and not had opportunity for a while because of what they did. And so I took them, and I didn't regret it a bit. I mean, gosh, Jody Hamilton just – and Jody and I – we're going to have history for 14 years after this. This is his first time for me, but he's going to be a regular down in Pensacola. He's going to be a regular with Continental. He becomes a very close personal friend. And I'm so happy that I did give him the opportunity to come in.
I want to return to Knoxville in a moment, Ron, but let's go to the other side of the state this period of time, early April 1975, because Jerry Jarrett was a tremendous friend to you as a promoter, supplying you with talent, including himself, for these shows in Knoxville when you needed it, when you were still building out your crew. But you were also helping him out because he had banished Jerry Lawler from Memphis for a period of time, and you went into Memphis and you became a big star there, and you were only doing the arena shows, as we know. You never appeared on TV. But what was going on in Memphis with you at this period of time in April of 75?
Actually, you know, it becomes not just me at this point. It becomes the Welches. It becomes the Fullers. My dad comes and my brother Robert starts working there as well. And, you know, Memphis just lights up. I mean, you know, you said, I did well there. I mean, we just, it goes crazy. And I want to talk about three Monday night events here in a row. And on Monday, March 31st, I lost a non-title match to Dale Lewis. And the match right before me, the semifinal, was my father, Buddy Fuller, and my brother, Robert, wrestling against the great Australian team of George Barnes and Bill Dundee. The attendance that night in Memphis was 9,582 people. The next Monday night in Memphis, April the 7th, was with Dale Lewis again, but this time I successfully defended my Southern Championship against him, and my father and brother are on the semifinal that night again against the same two Australians. The attendance that night is 10,300 people. And the following Monday, on April 14th, I'm wrestling Jack Briscoe in Memphis for the World Heavyweight Championship with a sellout attendance of 11,300 with raised prices. And it was the first time that anyone had ever talked Jerry Jarrett into raising prices for a world title match. And I suggested it to him because I had seen it happen in Florida. When they brought the champion in, it became commonplace, and fans knew that it usually was going to cost maybe a dollar more for that event. So I suggested this to Jerry because of the huge crowds we had drawn on the two preceding Monday nights. And he told me the following Monday that Briscoe, on the world title night, was the largest gross house so far he had ever had during his time as a booker. It sold out. He increased the price by a dollar. And in fact, it sold out in 20 minutes. I mean, he was concerned, Ron, the fans aren't used to paying that. Do you think they'll pay a dollar? I said, Jerry, you'll never know till you try it, man. And it sold out practically instantly. It was a tremendous, tremendous event for him and a tremendous night for my family as well. So my photo, for this Studcast number 96 is a shot of the inside of the Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis with an 11,000-plus crowd like this Jack Briscoe event. And it'll give fans an idea of what more than 11,000 people in a beautiful building like that look like. And if you'd like to check it out, you can look on my website at tnstud.com on the Studcast page or the gallery. And then when you take a look at that, fans take a look at that, just try to imagine what it's like to go out and wrestle in front of that type of crowd. I mean, it's a phenomenal thing to be a wrestler when you're in a building of that size and there's no seats available. No telling how many people couldn't get in that would like to come.
Well, it certainly sounds like you proved that the Welch family has a real ability to draw in Memphis with those events. Ron, if we add up those crowds, that is upwards of 30,000 people for three events. That's pretty impressive.
That's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And, I don't think the credit shouldn't all go to us. That's for sure. And I hadn't looked at it from that angle. That's a lot of people, over 30,000 in three events. Obviously, we're over pretty well. And it's even more remarkable when you consider that I'm a heel and my father and my brother are baby faces on the same cards. But a lot of credit must go to the city of Memphis itself and the great fans there. It's amazing to think about this fact here that when my dad went there and I was a big kid in the fifth grade, when he went to Memphis in 1958 and bought Memphis, his first show in Memphis drew less than 500 people. Now it's drawing 11,000 plus, and it's just a testament to the city itself. It truly was Memphis, I'm talking about, was truly one of the greatest wrestling cities in the world for professional wrestling.
You obviously have a very busy schedule. You're running your own territory. You're flying into Memphis for Monday nights. Do you work anywhere else in that territory during this period of time?
Yeah, I do. I'm going to work one time in on April 1st in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm going to be in a tag match with Phil Hickerson as my partner against George Barnes and Bill Dundee, and we're going to sell out the building in Louisville on that April 1st night. George Barnes and Bill Dundee are really, really over in that territory at this point, and it really doesn't make much difference who you booked with them. You're going to have a big house. And while we're on that subject, Brian, something else is going on during this time frame that I think fans might enjoy hearing about. I don't think there was ever was a situation similar to what was occurring in Memphis during this 3-week period. I doubt there ever was a family that wrestled on the same card in which one member was a heel and the other two family members were baby faces on that same card. Imagine a card in which the fans cheer the father and his youngest son in one match, and the very next match, the main event, they boo like crazy the older son. I mean, I don't think that's ever happened. I don't know in my career, I'd never seen that happen, where family members were on opposite sides, in opposite dressing rooms, and one group gets cheered and the other one gets booed. So it was a strange situation, but we were doing really, really phenomenal business there. On the first of those three cards, on that Monday night, March 31st, my father and brother wrestled against the Australians as babyfaces, and I wrestled the next match, obviously, as a heel. I've got the crowd itself. I got to give the crowd itself credit for switching me from heel to babyface over this next 2-week period. Jared had not discussed making me a babyface. And I don't think Jerry wanted to make me a babyface. But what happens in these two tag matches on these 2 weeks is going to make me a babyface because the fans are going to make it happen. I've never seen that happen either. So on this first of three huge Mondays, the fans are going crazy with my brother and my father in their tag match with the Aussies. And I'm standing in the back of the building and watching, and right in plain sight of all 9,500 people on that first night, March 31st, there's 9,582 people there. The third Aussie, there's a third Aussie in the territory, a guy named Johnny Gray, and he's standing right beside me. And I can see the crowd hardly takes their eye off of me because I'm standing there watching my father and my brother wrestle against two Australians, and their buddy is standing right next to me. It's a strange situation for the crowd, and it's a strange situation for me. So I can tell that the crowd's watching both of us, and I think they're anticipating what's going to happen if Johnny Gray leaves my side and goes down there to get involved in that match. And toward the end of the, what a great tag match. Toward the end of that match, that's exactly what happens. The Aussies get in trouble, and Johnny Gray, I mean, he charges off to the ring and to help his countrymen make the match now 2-3. And they ultimately win this match against my dad and my brother. And I stood there and watched them. Open Rob up. I saw him start bleeding, and then they pile drive my dad right in front of me, and I never made a move to help him. The fans were screaming at me, "Go, go, Ron, go help him, go help him." And in fact, as the end was going down and my brother was still bleeding and my father was being stretchered out, the crowd was focused on me. I walked back into the dressing room to a building full of boos from the entire crowd. When I came out the very next match for the main event to wrestle against Dale Lewis, I had more heat than I had ever had in Memphis. The crowd would not stop booing me. And Dale Lewis, it was his first night there. When we were being introduced, he says to me in the ring, he goes, "How in the world did you get this much heat, man?" You know, he couldn't figure out, you know. But what I did is by standing there and not going to help to my brother and my father, I became a monster heel right then. They hated me.
So that's week one. You mentioned there were three shows. What did you do week two?
Well, the next week, the crowd goes up. It's over 10,000 the following week, 10,300. And the same tag match, who is with Rob and my dad against Barnes and Dundee, was again right before my match. And the Mid-South Coliseum is a huge round structure. It has entrances built into the back of the building for bringing trucks, semi-trucks into the building and dropping off stages and whatever else they huge trucks could drive in both sides of the back of that building. And where those trucks entered, they had these huge metal screens that raised and lowered for access. So on that night, the huge metal screens were lowered. And there were again, Johnny Gray and I standing side by side watching the match that we had watched the Monday night before in which he got involved. And so everyone again was focused on us just as much as the match. I mean, it was exactly like the week before. And toward the end of the match, Johnny Gray, here he goes. He takes off. He charges down to the ring to help his friends. And I stand there and watch again, as I had done the week before. The crowd was going absolutely nuts. They could not believe I was going to do it again. And they were literally screaming over the railings and begging me, go help them. Go help them. What's wrong with you? And then I turned to go back into the dressing room as I'd done the week before. And as soon as I turned and headed for the dressing room, the roof came off. They booed. They weren't even watching the match. They were watching me and they just started booing me like crazy. And I disappeared from their view. And when I walked around the corner, I didn't go in the dressing room. They wouldn't stop. They were still booing. And so I turned. I couldn't leave. So, And both my father and Rob were bleeding in this particular match. And the crowd persistence, man, they just brought me back into the building. And, boy, when I suddenly came out of that dressing room again through that door and went to the ring, the roof came off that place. I had never heard that building so loud. And I ran to the ring and I just grabbed Johnny Gray. He was on the floor at that point by the back of his head and by his hair. And I started running with him toward the back of that building. And he was running by me. He had no choice. If he'd have gone down, I would have slammed his face in the concrete. So he had to try to keep up with me. And I ran him toward that giant metal screen in the back of that building. I don't think anybody ever did this before or since in Memphis. And when we were about 10 feet away from that screen, I just shot his body up into the air. And he hit that metal screen about 10 feet off the floor. He took the best bump backwards I had ever seen on the concrete floor. The crowd popped, and I just went right back into the dressing room as he laid there until his countrymen minutes later, after they lost the match, they came and peeled him off the concrete. I guess he stayed there for 5 minutes. That's kind of why I said earlier that the fans in this particular instance, they turned me babyface. It was not something Jerry wanted to happen, I don't believe. But I just felt like, God, I can't do this 2 weeks in a row. I can't just walk to the dressing room and let that happen twice in a row. So when I went back for the main event after I did that, I got a standing ovation as soon as they saw my face come out of the dressing room. The building stood up, and it's one of those times I got those chill bumps that many wrestlers hated to see. And I was never ever booed in Memphis again after that.
Ron, we will return in just one moment with more of the story, but first, let's go to this word about Super Studcast number 17 with your cousin, Jimmy Golden.
Super Studcast number 17 with Jimmy Golden has captured the hearts of fans around the world at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. These two cousins from the Welch wrestling family have a chemistry together that is very rare, plus 50 years of knowledge in old school wrestling. If you're a fan of wrestling history, you should not miss this opportunity to take a close look at just two of the 22 wrestlers from the largest wrestling family on the planet and hear for yourself why they they've left their mark on this great sport. Hilarious and historic, this Super Studcast number 17, Part 1, will leave you on the edge of your seat until Part 2 is released on Tuesday, May 28th at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 for the best 3 hours of wrestling and experiences available in podcasting.
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 17, available right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. It's the best deal in wrestling. For only $2.99, you get in the door and you get hours and hours and hours of amazing wrestling content, including the latest Super Studcast number 17 with Jimmy Golden. I said at the top, there's history, there's hilarity, there is the Welch cousins having a good time. You need to check this out. tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, before the break, you were in Memphis. Let's return to Knoxville. What's going on in Knoxville?
Well, next up is the Knoxville card back in Chiai Park, just 5 days after the Coliseum card. For listeners that are joining us for the first time, and gosh, we've got a lot of those, Brian, our numbers just keep growing. Studcast 95 will give them all the details about that second Coliseum show if they missed that one or they'd like to hear about that. But we have no TV to advertise this card for Friday, March 28th. We wrestle on Sunday, March 23rd, and there's no television or anything to advertise this Friday, March 28th card. And that had worried me all week about how we were going to drop off significantly because that we didn't have a TV to push the next event. But we still had an amazingly good crowd in the smaller Chiai Park building. And I think that might have happened because we had a lot of brand new fans that attended the Coliseum show and then came for the first time ever to the small building. What is happening with these Coliseum shows, I believe, is these first two Coliseum shows were creating interest that started making new fans for us. And many of those fans, I believe, were not willing to go to Chiai Park building until now. Once they went to the Coliseum and they saw it and they got a little taste for it, they're willing then to go to the small building because we're starting to hook them. We're starting to make fans out of them. And it, to me, was proof that things were changing when it came to wrestling in Knoxville. We were headed in the right direction, and I really felt it on that Friday night when we're still almost full in the small building and we've had no television or anything to even advertise on it.
So let's go to this show, Ron. Let's go to your return to Chilhowie Park, Friday night, March 28th, 1975.
Well, the first match on that card was Tojo Yamamoto beating former tag champion John Foley. Like I said, I'd gotten a notice from him. So, you know, there's no need, obviously, to put them over. And Tojo has been there on a few shows, and he's starting to get over. And in the second match, Dutch Mantel, the other guy that's leaving, happens to be wrestling against Jerry Jarrett. And Dutch puts Jerry over by disqualification, and I thought that was good. I was happy with Dutch, and I was happy with the way that John Foley left. That pleased me that I had Jerry as one of those guys that he's really helping me at this point, and he's there himself, and he's starting to get over a little bit there as well. The third match on this card is I want to spend a little time match with. And this is Danny Hodge against my cousin Jimmy Golden. These same two guys had wrestled against each other in the Coliseum just 5 days earlier. And they had a fantastic 30-minute time limit draw match. One of the great wrestling matches that you will ever see. Fantastic match. So this match is now 45-minute time limit for that reason, because the time limit ran out at 30. I said, let's put this at 45. Let's see what the heck happens here. And at the beginning of the match, Hodge shook hands with Golden in the middle of the ring before the bell. And when Jimmy turned to walk back to his corner, the bell rang. Hodge attempted a quick win. He wanted to beat him really fast. And he rushed Jimmy from behind and attempted O'Connor roll him. backward after smashing him in the corner. He intended to roll him up, but Jimmy was too smart for that. I was really surprised. Jimmy reversed it when he ran him, when he grabbed him from behind and he started shoving him to the corner. Jimmy just stuck that arm in there right in front of Hodge's leg. He flipped himself around behind Hodge, kept him running, and Jimmy jammed Hodge into the corner and rolled him up instead. The referee counted Hodge out, and the crowd popped. I was like, I popped. I'm standing up there watching. I was like, whoa, wow. He goes, no one had ever beaten Hodge that fast. I'm sure. There's no doubt. And Danny went berserk. I mean, he just was jumping around and banging the ropes. Jimmy slid out on the floor. The crowd just mobbed him, man. It was like, wow, that's unbelievable. You beat Danny Hodge in 6 seconds or something. So, And Hodge goes nuts. I mean, he demands the microphone from the announcer. The announcer says, ladies and gentlemen, the winner of the match in 6 seconds or whatever is Jimmy Golden. And Hodge just grabs the microphone away and he starts claiming that, hey, the bell rang before it should have. And he had all these excuses. And he kept telling Jimmy, he kept begging him, come back here, man, And he's all surrounded by fans. He's headed to the dressing room, and the fans boo Hodge like crazy. And Danny continues to scream at Jimmy on the microphone, come back to the ring for a second try. You can't do that again. You'll never beat me again. And Jimmy finally agrees to give him a second match. And so Jimmy goes back to the ring. The crowd kind of settles down just a little bit. They get ready to go again. They ring the bell. They shake hands just like they did in the first one. They shake hands again. And this time, when Hodge turns to go to his corner and the bell is already rung, Jimmy tries to pull the same trick. He rushes Hodge from behind, and Hodge reverses him. And Jimmy's smart enough and fast enough that he re-reversed Hodge and slammed him in face first again, rolled him up, and the referee counts him out again. 1, 2, 3. Oh, my God. The crowd went absolutely crazy, man. Now he's beaten Danny Hodge twice in 12 seconds. I mean, Hodge just was absolutely livid. I mean, Jimmy left the ring. The fans were just all over him. Jimmy was a star. That made a absolute star out of Jimmy in that one match. And Danny was really upset when he got back to the dressing room, and his anger is because of what went down is going to cost me a lot of money in the very next match.
Danny wasn't crazy about the finish being him getting pinned in 12 seconds.
No, he's like, gosh, man, that how can you, that'll get him over. I said, that's the point, Danny. That will get the kid over, they could have gone out there and had another long match, had another draw. Jimmy would have left that ring after 45 minutes and not been nearly the star he was with a finish like that. But Danny didn't really like the idea, and he was a little bit upset. I think we talked in the last episode or so about Danny was 46-0 as an amateur at the University of Oklahoma and never had anybody even take him down. He had Jimmy Golden beat him twice in 12 seconds. It was like, wow, I really appreciated what Danny did for Jimmy, and so did Jimmy, obviously.
You mentioned earlier when talking about Memphis that you went in there and you main evented against Dale Lewis. Of course, Dale Lewis is working for you on the other side of the state here in Knoxville. And in fact, you guys team up on this night.
Yes, we do. In fact, on the Coliseum show, Nelson Royal and Les Thatcher won the Tennessee Tag Championships from Mantell and Foley. And we're going to wrestle them for those titles. That's the main event for the night. And Dale insisted that he still wants to take on a challenger from the crowd before the tag match. And I thought, well, I don't see how that's going to fit in here, Dale. But he says, Ron, it's what we do. And there's going to be guys, there's going to be challengers out there that want to do it. And so I said, well, I tell you what, why don't we do it before the semi-match, which is a ladies' world championship match with Fabulous Moolah. She was scheduled for the fourth match. I said, let's have one person. You will just beat one challenger this night, and then we'll go back in the main event. So he agreed on that. And, you know, the fans had seen a lot of these challenge matches with guys from the crowd. Dale was only going to beat one guy, as we agreed upon. And when the challenge match was ready to start, I was standing on the second level of the building. And you look down on the ring. It was a smaller building. There had bleachers up on that second level as well. But the side where the dressing room was, there were no bleachers and no people, basically. That was all cut off from fans, and they couldn't get in that particular area. And I always watched matches from that second level, looking straight down on the ring. And guess who joins me and stands right beside me watching that match from the same level as I? Danny Hodge. You know, Danny watched all these shoots. And as I have said repeatedly in the last few studcasts, that he's upset with the way Dale is handling this. And now Danny's, you know, he wasn't real happy with the finish here. And now he's standing there watching me, with me, watching Dale down there. And that night, this opponent's a little larger than most of the guys that Dale had been wrestling, and he seemed to be cocky and trying to act tough even before the bell rang. He seemed to me like a real jerk. You know, I'm watching and I'm thinking, oh, this guy's he's an ass, man. You know, what's his deal, you know? And I got a real bad feeling in the pit of my stomach about this guy. And, you know, and I don't know why, but I remember I felt like, wow, you know, well, this guy's just something wrong with this dude, you know. So Lewis locks up with him, and at the very beginning of the match, I rang the bell, and he backs him into the ropes right off the bat, and the referee calls for a break. Lewis throws up his hands for a clean break. And he does this with all of these challenge matches because he's going to take these guys, and there's no doubt that they're never going to touch Dale Lewis. You know, he throws his hands up and he starts to back away. And the guy tries to stick his fingers in his eyes. And it was so obvious that Danny's standing right next to me. We both see it. We both recognize that this guy's trying to hurt Dale. He's trying to do something that I have not seen any challengers do. So he tries to stick his fingers in Dale's eyes. And Dale didn't even seem to get upset because he's so low key and everything. And he backed away and he's in complete control. But Danny, standing next to me, he's a totally different animal, by golly. And he starts screaming at Dale from where we are up in the balcony. And he screams down there and he goes, "Hurt him!" You know, and I turn to Danny and say, "No, Danny, no, he has this under control." So Dale locked up again. They go back together. Dale locks up again with the guy, and this time he forces the guy back into the corner. And the referee calls for the break again. Dale throws his hands up in the air and starts to back away, and the guy takes a swing at him. And Dale grabs the guy pretty firmly, and he just takes him down on the mat. But Danny's still standing next to me. And now, instead of saying "hurt him," Danny screams at him again. And he says, "Kill him." And in an instant, I mean, you know, I can't even turn to say something to Danny. He's gone. He heads to the ring. He goes down the steps and down to the first floor. And he's right up to ringside, and he's screaming at Dale all the way down there, "Kill him, kill him," you know, and I'm screaming just as loud as Danny is at Danny. I'm going, "No, Danny, no, 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 please, please don't get involved," you know. So by the time Danny gets to the ring, Dale had the guy on his back, and he was about to pin him. It would have all been over right then if it had not been for Danny. But Danny arrives at the ring about the point where this guy's down and Dale's about to just pin him and get this done. And once Danny gets to the ring, he's screaming so loud I can hear him up at the top of the building. Everybody in the building can hear him. And So when he arrives at ringside, he screams at Dale, and he's pretty close to where Dale is now. And he goes, "Don't you pin that son of a bitch. Stomp him in the face." And I go, "Oh, no, no." I'm thinking, "Oh, my God, no, no." So I can hear what had Danny screaming and, you know, way up on the second floor. So I start screaming, Dale, I scream, "No, Dale, don't do it. Pin him. Go on and pin him, man." You know, but he can't hear me, right? So, and he's close to Danny, so he can obviously hear what Danny's saying. That. So he plainly hears Danny's demands, as everybody else in the building hears Danny's demands. And Dale's in the process, basically, of about to pin him, and he's on top of him. And Danny's only a few feet away from him now. He's right there at ringside. And he screams again really loud. He says, "If you don't stomp that son of a bitch in the face, I'm going to come in there for you."
Wow.
Oh, my gosh. Now it's gone to another level here, right? I'm like, oh, my goodness, no. So, you know, almost every wrestler on earth fears Danny Hodge. And Dale Lewis is no exception. I can tell you that. So Dale gets up off the guy. And the guy's laying there helplessly because he's blown up, and Dale's been, you know, he's roughing him up a little bit when he took the swing at him. So Danny screams again. Now the guy's laying on his back, and he's blown up, and basically he would have been finished and out of the ring and would have been done with. But Danny's right there, and he screams one more time. He says, "Stomp that son of a bitch in the face, Dale." And I go, I scream as loud as I can. One last try. "Don't do it, Dale. Pity, pity." I'm just begging. "No, Dale, don't do it." Dale stands there. He doesn't know what to do until he sees Danny reach and get the ropes like he's going to come up on the apron. And that's as far as he's going to. That's as close as Dale wants Danny. I can tell you that. He doesn't want Danny in that ring with him. So. And as far away as I am, I can see the fear in Dale's eyes. I know it's all over here. One last scream. Oh, I got to try once more. "Dale, don't do it, man. Don't stop him." You know, but it's too late. Well, I see Dale raise that big old size 14 foot. And I mean, down it comes. Gosh almighty. Blood shoots across the ring. And the jerk's laying there motionless, man. And then soon he's covered in blood. Dale leaves the ring. He puts a foot on his chest. And the referee counts the guy out. He's a bloody mess. And he leaves the ring. And when he leaves, Danny's right by his side. And in my opinion, Danny's forced this. This is all Danny's fault. I mean, he forced Dale to do something Dale would have never done himself. And all the way back to the dressing room, Danny's right in Dale's face, giving him crap, you know, because he didn't stomp him soon enough. I don't know what he would disliked about the way he stomped him, but it was a bad deal. So I had to make a quick decision how best to handle this catastrophe, you know, and I thought at the moment, my night was ruined and so was my future, man. This is just as horrible a thing as could possibly have happened in my first few months as a wrestling owner.
Well, two quick questions, Ron. When a guy got under the ring for a challenge match with Dale Lewis, did they have to sign anything? Did they have to say, "I won't sue even if I get stomped in the face" or anything else? And secondly, he had been working for you for a while as a heel, but had you ever seen Danny Hodge this angry?
No, I had never seen Danny that angry. And yes, there was a document that was signed. I had it drawn up by an attorney before we ever started doing these challenge matches, because I anticipated somebody might get hurt. And basically the document says that you take all the responsibility in your own hands, and you realize that you're out there trying to win money, and that if you get injured in the process, that you can't do anything about it. But gosh, when I'm standing up there and looking at this guy's bloody face and he's unconscious, I'm wondering, you know, is this gone way past the point of no return here? You know, it's like, I know he signed the document, but because we had everybody do it that went in the ring with Dale, But, you know, Danny was just out of total control here. Maybe, you know, he just disliked the finish with Jimmy so much, the concept of losing twice in the same way in 12 seconds, that it turned his night upside down, and he turned my night upside down because of it. I can tell you that. That's for darn sure.
Well, we still have a couple more matches on the show, including you and Dale Lewis teaming up. Obviously, this was not in your plans when you started booking out the show, but there's also a Women's World Championship match on the show, or maybe I should say the World's Ladies Championship. Talk about that.
We're going to wrestle for the Tennessee tag titles, but the next matchup is the Fabulous Moolah against her opponent, and it really didn't make any difference who her opponent was, because Moolah had trained most of those girls anyway, and she was definitely in control with all of her matches, and with the people that she trained. She was the woman that when it came to it, and she's wrestling against Ann Casey that night, who is a very polite and nice girl, just a pleasure to be around. And Moolah, mean and vicious. I mean, that's the way I would have to describe her. She was really mean and vicious in the ring, and she had no pity on these girls that she trained. I cringed a few times myself just watching what the ladies' world champion was capable of. I mean, Moolah was, wow, she was as bad as any shooter you'd ever see. And actually, she had some shooter capability. She had been trained by people that had taught her how to wrestle and how to hurt people. And she had no qualms about doing it with these lady wrestlers that she had trained. And over the next 14 years, I'm gonna become somewhat friends with Lillian Ellison. That's Fabulous Moolah. And I'm going to use her on quite a few really big shows where I want to have triple world championships. I want to have a world heavyweight NWA world title on the line. I want to have an NWA junior heavyweight championship title on the line. And I want to have a world's ladies title on the line. And I do that quite a bit over the next 14 years. And Lillian is going to work for me quite a few times. And she's going to wrestle on some of the biggest crowds Southeastern and Continental are going to ever draw.
Hey, one question, Ron, because I know he was centered out of, I think, Nashville. Did you ever meet Buddy Lee, Moolah's ex-husband, who later would marry Rita Cortez?
Buddy Lee and my father were great friends. Buddy Lee was in the music business. I never met Buddy Lee, but I remember my dad talking about Buddy Lee a lot. He was a huge wrestling fan, and I don't know exactly what he did. He was a producer in the music business or whatever. He's in Nashville. I mean, obviously he's in a great city for that. But I wasn't even aware that Lillian had married Buddy Lee, to be honest with you. See, I don't do my research like you do, Brian. I don't dig into all the things that I should. So, but that's kind of shocking to me, because my dad mentioned Buddy Lee many, many times, and had a great friendship and relationship with Buddy Lee.
So let's now go to this main event, Ron. The Tennessee Tag Team Championship on the line. The champions, Les Thatcher and Nelson Royal, versus Ron Fuller, yourself, and Professor Dale Lewis.
Yes, and you know, bear in mind now, this has been a crazy night when we go to the ring. And you know, I'm not myself. Dale Lewis is not himself at this point. Danny Hodge has certainly not been himself during the course of this night. It's been a wild and crazy evening for me. And so in this match, I'm going to leave Dale Lewis in the end of this match alone by himself with both Nelson Royal and Les Thatcher. Just basically walk away from him when he's trying to get a tag and when he's trying to his best to for us to win the match. I'm just going to step off the apron and just go straight to the dressing room. And obviously, by the time I leave, they shoot in there and they double team him. And by the time I make it to the dressing room and look over, they're finishing him off in the ring. And that's the first match that Dale Lewis has lost since he came to Knoxville. And I have left him in there. And the next week, on the next Friday night, I'm going to be wrestling against him for my Southern Heavyweight Championship because I left him. But because of the way the tag match ended, then obviously I'm going to defend against him the next Friday night. And it's been a crazy night. Like I said, I've never been in this type of circumstances before. The events of this night obviously refreshing my mind at that point. And I'm, like I said, now I'm in as bad a mood as Hodge and Lewis are. And the tag match that I just ended was pretty much a blur to me. I really don't remember a whole lot of the tag match, to be honest with you. But because as we're in the ring and as this is going down, I watched them take this guy that Dale has bloodied up, this challenger, out on a stretcher to an ambulance that's outside with its lights flashing. You can see it through the windows of the building. And he's looks like he's unconscious, and they've got his neck in a brace. That was it for me. I mean, you know, I think that's the point. I got off the apron and just went to the dressing room. I was finished, and I really felt like I was not just finished with that night, that maybe I was finished as an owner of a company. I had no idea what to expect out of this horrible thing that had taken place during the course of this night. And it was undoubtedly one of the worst nights of my wrestling career.
Two quick questions before we wrap things up, Ron. One, as you're watching this guy, this fan being taken out on a stretcher, bloody, are you thinking all the things? Is everything going through your head? I'm going to get sued. I'm going to get shut down. This is going to be a problem. And also, in terms of this main event match, you clearly, if you look at the lineups, you were ready for another top babyface. And you against Professor Dale Lewis would have been a really good long-term program because you've been building him up for months. This is the first time he loses a match here, and it's you that cost him the match. Instant babyface right there. Right away, you have an instant challenger, and we have a brand new babyface. But these events happen. Does that change the way you think about what you're going to be able to do?
Well, you know, you're right about the first part. You know, I started seeing all these things, you know, lawsuits and you know, just problem after problem and how it could have all been avoided if Danny had just left the situation alone. And you're right also about Dale being a great babyface. I mean, he's been a heel with me side by side for months. He has not been beaten. I've not lost a lot of matches either. And it was a perfect setup to bring him back as a babyface. But I think as time goes by here, a lot of things are going to happen in the next couple of weeks here that are going to change everything. You know, this stomp in the face goes way beyond just one guy being injured. It's going to affect Danny. It's going to affect Dale, and it's going to affect me.
Well, I guess that's a good time to wrap things up, and we'll certainly see where this goes next time with all of this. But Ron, as we do close out this show, we want to remind everyone that you are on Facebook, and we encourage everyone to join your Facebook page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcast. And I also want to mention that the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network is on Twitter at Super Podcasts, as well as on Facebook, facebook.com/Arcadian Vanguard. We talked about it a little earlier. Super Studcast number 17 with Ron's cousin Jimmy Golden is a big hit right now with patrons around the world. Check it out. Part one is up. Part two is coming very, very soon, and you will love it. Check out the first 90 minutes right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. It's only $2.99 to get you in the door. It's the best deal in wrestling, and there are so many action-packed, history-packed Super Studcast and rest of the stories out there. You definitely need to check it out. We have a lot of new listeners, like you mentioned earlier, Ron. We encourage you, if you enjoy what we bring you each and every week on the Studcast, check out the Super Studcast, patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, we're going to go back and revisit my commentator problem that is still there with Big Jim Hess, and how that problem is going to lead to probably the most important decision I will ever make concerning Southeastern Wrestling in Knoxville. Plus, there's no way we can avoid going back and dipping right back into this $1,000 challenge disaster, as I call it, I guess is a good word for it, and how I'm going to deal with Hodge and Lewis because of this. It's pretty remarkable how things in wrestling work, and this is really a tough time for a 27-year-old young owner of a brand new wrestling company, and we're going to see what I'm made out of.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.